Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
episode whatever, Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, the epic story at the start that gives a slice for up to part 5. Had a bit of a break while I did amazing things down at Wollongong. We've just looked at the use of the sun, various uses of the sun. Now, this is practical uses. Now, it's probably looking at, inspired by the star, these are the cultural impacts of the sun. And it's chapter 23, The Vital Symbol. Mitra, the brothers Kasimov. In the Brothers Kasimov. I sort of remember this is an old 1950s book. I see the sun, and if I don't see the sun, I know it's there. And there's a whole life in that, in knowing the sun is there. Okay, I don't want to say that. William Blake, A Vision of the Last Judgment. What? It will be questioned when the sun rises. Do not see a round disc of fire, something like a guinea? Oh no, I see an innumerable company of heavenly hosts crying, holy, holy, holy is the Lord, it is the Lord God Almighty. Wow.
Well, it does look a bit like a round guinea. I think it actually looks like a liquid drop myself,
honestly. Anne Frank would regularly confide to her diary how inspired she felt when she looked at the old white horse chestnut outside the small house where her family were hiding from the Nazis, especially when the tree was lit up by the morning sun. As long as this exists, I may live to see the sunshine cloudless sky, while last I cannot be unhappy. The sun, either in itself or as an embodiment of what was good in nature, inspires all kinds of ways. It is the most ubiquitous symbol, appearing frequently in heraldry when representing as giving light, its sun radiant and with a human face in sun and splendor, and is one of the most popular institutional emblems for everything from oil conglomerates to the Smithsonian. In the UK alone, 497 trademarks employ it, against 366 that use the crown and 339 that use the Union Jack. Well, there you go. One wonders which world culture would has the most elaborate solar imagery. 20 nations display the sun on their flags: Antigua, Argentina, Bangladesh, Ivory Coast, Japan, Macedonia, Mali, Namibia, Nepal, Nicaragua, Niger, Philippines, Rwanda, Taiwan, Tunisia, and Uruguay, all full face sun in splendor. As well as a little known countries such as Bergonia, Kazakhstan, Kiribati, and Kyrgyzstan. The newly designed Oz flag, the national emblem in some of Australia, features a black kangaroo leaping across the sun, while several countries have solar stripes. India has a golden wheel representing the 24 hours of the day, while the Oval Office boasts a huge yellow sunburst on its carpet. I would like to point out the Aboriginal flag is a big yellow sun, but I don't know what to forget that one. This is the Australian Aboriginals. Japan takes its flag from the rising sun banner first displayed in the court in 1701. In 1870, the scarlet and white design known as the Nimaru, the sun flag, was adopted. The Imperial Japanese Navy, the Army too, until 1945, was given its own emblem showing the sun 16 rays. Because Yutuki, yet amongst the several hundred family crests in Japan, while 51 depict stars and 17 the moon, only 7 bear the sun. As if even the greatest nobleman felt they could never be on such an intimate term with such an imperial an entity. Royalty feels no such qualms on the 3rd of February 1461, during the 15th century struggle between the rifle houses of Lancaster and York, known as the War of the Roses. Edward IV, he was about to become, from 1442 to 83, and his army reached Mortimer's Cross, a hamlet in the South Shropshire, ready to do battle against the Lancastrian foe. Edward, only 21 years old, had just heard his father and the youngest brother had been captured, mocked and slaughtered. His troops were battle-weary and low heart. As dawn broke, three suns appeared to the sky and suddenly joined together as one. What the heck is that? I don't know. That would be probably the dog stars, the sun dogs, I suppose. Hilary Manuel, in his novel, well, there you go, I think that's sun dogs, which are special crystals which reflect parallel to the sun left and right. Hilary Manuel, in her novel Wolf Hall, brings what happens to dramatic life. Edward could see three blurred discs of silver sparkling hazy through the particles of frost, so it is probably a sundog. The garland light spread over the sorry fields, over sodden forests and Welsh borderlands, over his demoralised and unpaid troops. Taking place was most likely perihelion, a dispersion of light through ice crystals, and though it could also have been the morning sun simply reflected off the wetlands to the east. So that's perihelion in sundogs. Whatever the cause, the men cowered back from so awesome a sight for Edward to be inside to cry, "This is a good sign, for those three sons betoken the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost." At this, his whole army, reportedly between 5,000 and 1,000 strong, sank on their knees. We can see various sun things. Van Gogh of the sun, I love that. In prayer, then rose to storm victory. His whole life took wing and soared. In that wash of brilliant light, he saw this future. Edward went on to have the sun in splendour woven into his standards. The royal personage most closely identified with the sun was certainly Louis XIV, Roi Soleil, from 1438 to 1715. Unfortunately, because he did so well, the other Louis after the 16th went downhill. In 1653, at just 15 years of age, he appeared before the court wearing a golden wig and a broad tunic and a pink and white plumed headdress, crusted with rubies and ablaze with solar rays, while little sons blazed forth his garters and buckles and high-heeled shoes. My God, what a fancy. 9 years later, he staged an equestrian ballet between Louvre and the Tuileries before 5,000 guests. An opening extravaganza featured a troop of noblemen turned out in costumes representing the great civilizations. Louis himself, dressed as an Roman emperor, was with a golden cloak and shield carrying a solar emblem. After him, the Persians, led by his brother, whose escutcheon bore the emblem of the moon and the motto Uno Solo Minor, the lesser to the sun alone. 8 years on, Molière depicted Louis as Apollo in Les Amants Magnifiques, in which the king, once more comparison to the sun, appeared on stage in opera that climaxed in volcanoes and fireworks. My godfather, they really did go for it. On another occasion, let's see, this is the woven standards, there's a footnote there. This is going back to Edward. Edward also constructed suns as foretelling a happy reunion of his three sons of York, he himself, his brother George and Richard, and incorporated them into his ensign. For centuries, people punned sun on sun. In Richard III, the opening lines, "Now the winter of my discontent, made glorious summer by the son of York," play with the fact that the badge of Edward IV, son Duke of York, whose title had inherited, was a son. Shakespeare certainly knew the story of Mortimer's cross, as Edward explains in Henry IV. "Doth my eye, or do I see three sons?" Well, there you go. Sun dogs are really important. Okay. On another occasion, in the hours before the dawn of the 18th of August, 1674, Louis led his court through the palace garden, where he suddenly came upon a rocky island upon some 73 feet across, crowned with an 80-foot obelisk topped with a sphere of fiery light. The bas-relief depicted the king and king crossing a river at the head of his army. Below, to one side, sprawled a lion crushed at his feet, to the other an eagle in submission. The whole display burnt silently until a single 150 charges of powder were detonated as a firework fleur-de-lis blazed across the canal. Triumph for both the sun and son of justice sovereign was complete. My God, that's a completely nutcase. Identifying himself with the sun was a politically astute move, for it shed a quasi-divine magnificence over Louis. After all, the sun was my godfather. Oh my god. Heavenly body associated with Apollo, god of peace and the arts, as well as the symbol of the military god, which situated the Warriors Monarch's ambitions. Louis' decision was received with joy by contemporary chroniclers. Historian Father Claude François Ministre, perhaps the most famous Jesuit in France, rejoicing. My God, and then you've got 30 years of war. That France really lost out against when they 15th. And so this is Jesuits' rights. What grander and more heroic effort could be wished for than the action of the sun lighting up the whole world and working incessantly to maintain all that lies on it? What could be chosen more worthy of a king who promised such great things as soon as he started governing his states as his own? My God, the French were really suckered into kings. Then it was Versailles, the secret place that Louis made his supreme residence. The sun was not only a symbol on display, but it was cast all others into its shadow. Throughout, decorations combined images and attributes of Apollo, laurel, lyre, tripod, and king's portraits and emblems. The grand apartments glorified the most Christian king as the sun, and within it, Apollo's salon was designated as the main room. The regularity of the king's works, habits, and his regular rising and retirings were another point of comparison. One thinks of the journal entry 3 centuries on Walter Stevens, 1879 to 1855. The day of the sun is like a day of the king. It is a promenade in the morning, sitting on the throne at noon, and a pageant in the evening. Yet another point of comparison between the monarch and the sun is that both the star and the institution of royalty have been devalued in the intervening years. I like that. From the least of the 19th century on, the diminishing influence of the denuded cycle on the developed world's daily life and the evolution of scientific knowledge have made the sun less and less a mythological object. No longer regarded as the god of the divine powers, the easiest way to channel one's respect for it, it became associated with a new, more impersonal pantheon. It was the clock at our existence, maker of our weather, a late discovery, regulated with seasons and force that power over all life and death, but in a personal sense, not as an anthropized person deity that humans could appeal or placate. As we have become to understand it differently, the symbolic value has changed too. Oh God, this is great. The sun has always played a role in the religion for Jews. The 7 branches Manoah originally represented the burning bush seen by Moses at Mount Sinai, and thus the light of God. But in later readings, its arms signified the 5 then known planets, plus the moon and the central candle, the master sun. In Japan, the devout are advised that the best time for meditation is the moments before sunrise and sunset. To describe the transfiguration, evangelists could find no better simile than the sun's brilliant, the whiteness of light, and the apt image of the transition of the sun god from the world into flesh to that of the spirit. The sun has also appeared in visions between the 30th of May and the 13th of October 1917. A beautiful lady who said she came from heaven was said to have appeared 6 times to 3 young shepherds near the town of Fatima on the outskirts of Lisbon, the children reporting a dancing sun walking across the sky as a short instrument of God. As Fatima grew into one of the staging posts of the Christian pilgrimage, on the following 13th of October, crowds of more than 25,000 reported to have witnessed how the atmosphere became orange and the sun dimmed. Then the clouds suddenly parted and a bright light, like that of a halo, emanated from the gloom. The sun began to pin and change colour, and then hurtle earthwards. Okay, what he's really missing is that Parmenides, there's sun poem, he's missing that out. I wish he would say it. Other less famous apparitions, mirages, include the testimony of the 19th century Anglican churchman who was leaning idly against his father's carriage when he saw a group of fairies playing a few yards away. Get inside, ordered the unsympathetic parents. It's just the sun. Okay. From the 1960s on, sun-inspired visions of another kind arose from the part of the Western counterculture involved in taking psychedelic drugs. The father of LSD, Albert Hoffman, who died in 2008, for instance, became fascinated with the mechanisms through which plants turn sunlight into substances that transform mental states. Something comes from the sun, he said, reclaiming the gateway into the new forms of consciousness. Hoffman to study hallucinogenic substances found in Mexican mushrooms. The songwriter, singer Donovan, wrote one of his first psychedelic songs, Sunshine Superman, while the hippie musical Hair ended with the Let the Sunshine In, and people did. And, of course, drug-enhanced celebrations of the suns are not unique to any one group or country. Mirka Ile describes the mythology of the Desanas, a small tribe living in the equatorial forest of the Phelps River. In yes, hon? Here we go. Continuing reading after 15 minutes, I was interrupted there to serve the evening meal, and then a series of things that happened. It's the next day. We're reading this chapter called The Vital Symbol, and of course, he sort of saved up Louis the Sun King till to this chapter, and the symbol sort of overtook him. He used to dress up, as I referred to earlier on, in his sun costume with sun garters, sun hair, and had a huge symbolic fire. I think there's a picture of it in here. This obelisk with the Grand Canal fireworks. That's absolutely gone mad. The French, of course, it reminds me of Napoleon's coronation balloon. This holding things. Now, this chapter, it starts about drug-induced visions of the sun. Mesa Iliade describes the mythology of Desanas, a small tribe living in the equatorial forest of the Verps River on the Colombian Amazonian that persists in hunting-based culture, and whose religious mythology revolves around the creative power of the Sun Father. Well, I don't know how long they exist. To Desanas, says Iliade, the soul possesses its own luminosity bestowed by the sun at birth of every human being. This association is reinforced by the psychedelic drug Yaga, the drinking of which brings the innate subterranean world inhabited by luminous beings. Taking Yaga is expressed by a verb meaning drink and see. It is interpreted as Regius, a primeval movement when the Sun Father began the creation. Light, says LAD, is associated with sexuality. Another aspect of creation myth involves soul originating from semen and the fall that falls with the sun's rays. Well, this is pretty massive. It's also interesting about homunculus and the belief that there's male and female semen came together. It's pretty amazing. The male semen was stronger. It seems if everything which exists lives and procreates in animation of the sun, and if spirituality, intelligence, wisdom, clairvoyance, etc., partakes of the nature of solar light, it follows that every religious act has, at the same time, a seminal and visionary meaning. The sexual connotations of light experiences and the hallucinatory visions appear to be logical consequences of coherent solar theology. Oh, well, there you go. Perhaps solar myths confirm, reassure, and inspire. It's up to the individual taste whether they do more than that. There have ever been plenty of innocent, practical ways of taking the sun as inspiration. The wheel, first seen in the Pictogram of Uruk in the Mesopotamia around 350 BC, is one example. Yoga practitioners perform the sun salutation, they salute the sun. Ted Hughes demanded that his publishers bring out his poems only in days when the Earth's magnetic field was prosperous. Mata Hari, I think she was a famous dancer, and she died in 1917. Yes, I think she was a German spy, or whatever it is. 1876 to 1917. So she was nice to me. She was a Dutch erotic artist shot by the French and German as a spy, took his stage name of Malay of the Sun, literally Eye of the Day. The game of polo descended from a competition amongst one hall tribesmen who whack a human head up and down the field, a pastime said to have a solar origin. A similar version of the game appeared in Persia in the 5th century BC, horsemen driving not a skull but a lighted fireball across the sky field in the Sun game. I realise that the list above will appear arbitrary, but that is how it is with the Sun. Oh, what a lovely, lovely way he goes. It finds its way into odd and uncategorisable areas. There are subjective details for them. How the Sun has affected language, its common symbol, the blonde hair and golden mirrors. Alexander the Great wore a gold sun ribbon around his head, so various children's legends, but not official legends, have the his gold band falling to the sea, and he knew he was going to die of malaria. Words based on the Sun, or influenced by it, reflect cultural attitudes. The names, both people and places, frequently have something in solar. In Persia, such names as Afos, Afid, Dahi, Dori, Fahmi, Jaha, Gorshed, Kershid, Mashir, Mirsid, Sam, Shilus, Talia, all mean sun, and are still used. They are many a game meaning light, dazzling. In Sanskrit, Asia means sunrise. Isn't that amazing? Jadita, translate as victorious sun. Korvash, the sun lovely. Ravi and Ravina means sun. Ra, in many languages, being used by both people's names to cover the important sun-related concepts. In Japanese, Nippon remains origin of the sun. Oh, isn't that, so Asia means sunrise, and Nippon means origin of the sun. In the northern hemisphere, the further north or west one goes in the old world, the less likely one is to find such equivalences. Sun-related positional vocabulary is still used in celestial navigation, but geographical terms, Orient, Occident, Levant, have died away. Though so much of our culture is Mediterranean connected, that there still is a repository of such metaphor, English especially, not because the climate is, but because the writers enjoyed thinking up new solar phrases. Shakespeare coined several. To burn daylight, with an expression for wasting time occurring in The Merry Wives of Windsor and Romeo and Juliet. Street slang makes full use of the sun. The chilling phrase, a Harlem sunset, describes a wound given by a razor fight. God. Introduced by Raymond Chandler in 1940 and used in a novel since in a poem by Seamus Heaney. Oh, so I'm just really trying to burn some of that. In Asia means sunrise, Nippon. Oh, gee, that's sick. The sundowner is both a tramp in the Australian bush, someone who comes to a sheep station at sunset for food and shelter, and a strict naval captain, originally one who compelled midshipmen to return from his shore leave by sundown. It's said, well, this is, I don't think the sundowner guest cabins we have in Australia, hotels, they're subsidiary hotels. It is said to be time for drinking when the sun is over the forehead or over the yardarm, since the home waters and the northern latitudes of the sun would be over the yardarm. One horizontal spars mounted on the masts of the old sailing ships. Towards noon, the drinking hour evidently started earlier. Many proverbs revolve around the sun. Some of more imaginative include, the same sun will melt the butter, will harden the clay. The sun doesn't shine on both sides of the hedge at once. Flying into the sun, meaning being so passionately committed to destroy oneself. It's interesting he hasn't done Icarus. I'm sure it will come up. While sunflower is a pretty girl, i.e. someone unfolding for suns. And the sunbeam means tableware that hasn't been used and so doesn't have to be washed. Oh dear. The sunfisher is slang for bucking a horse, but to get the sun into a horse's coat is to allow the horse to rest from racing. Most different derivations are easy enough to tease out. Solar plexus is so named because the ganglia radiate from the stomach much area throughout the body. And when Archie Goodwin in Nero Wolfe's book describes things as sun fast, he means they are certain because the sun dyes do not bleach out, but others do mystify. To be intensely nervous is to be walking in the sun. The legal world has its own way of words. A sunshine law is one that forbids the government to pass edicts without there being a certain amount of time for them to be considered by the public. Well, isn't it sunset? Sunlight. Daylight is a legal term stipulating the period of time after sunrise and before sunset is to be considered part of the day and not night. Often invoked when defining burglary. One of the oldest names of the sun, the Spanish fagot, which appears in the Grouse Dictionary of 1811. This may have come about because of the 15th century and continuing through to the reign of Carlos I. Coins of Spain and its dominions were stamped with the images of faggots, the sheaths of arrows loosely bound together, which is seen similar to the sun's rays. If there's one colour that symbolises the sun, it's yellow. Just look at the yellow sun, exclaims Neil Foolish, the heroine of South Street. The sun can be orange and, of course, red or white, but yellow is a tyranny colour. Given the fact, I wish you would explain this, I will have to re-examine my knowledge of the cone cells, the light cone cells, how they are individual. You've got three cells, one, two, and three, but they also give a differential signal. So that's one or two minus three, or one or three minus two. The antagonistic is quite interesting. So if one or two are going and three is not there, it switches off and gives you a sensitivity for it, if I understand it. Given the fact, however, the various shades of the sun can have their own, can take on challenged human ingenuity. The varieties of solar yellows stocked by paint suppliers range from the time and weather tints, high noon, low rise, sun shower, sun porch, and so on. The golds from the falls through to golden pond to such possibilities, solar colours as yellow brick road, mellow yellow, and ho-hum yellow. Unless I do not explain, it seems hardly surprising in the light of such inventory that the British artist Sir Terry Frost, who died in 2003, captured by the Germans, oh God, when they overran Creek in 1941, that was a disaster. And of course the Germans gave up. It was, okay, the parachutists won there, but God, spent his activity experimenting with yellow and came up with 381 shades, all part of the sun's wardrobe. Human beings nearest the sun in colour to their hair, the women of ancient Rome would bleach themselves to blondness with quicklime and wood ash, jealous of the German slave women brought back by the soldier husbands. A blonde head typically has many more strands than dark or red, and blondes have long been thought to be more fertile. Oh my God. In their cultural history of species, Janet Pittman points out the majority of heroines in fairy stories are blonde, and Beauty and the Beast to Cinderella, Goldilocks and Rapunzels. Men of ancient Greece were bewitched by blonde hair, she adds, for represented fantasy and wealth. Above all, it was sexy, luminous and bright. It shimmered and glowed, producing a country of few natural blondes, a rare and exciting contrast to the massive Mediterranean dark hair all around. Golden was the master epithet of Aphrodite and of all of Homer's work. I think Alexander the Great was blonde. Let's see if they say this. Blondness, says Pittman, became the prejudice of the Dark Ages. Obsession and Renaissance, a mystique in Elizabethan England, Elizabeth herself, was auburn hair, a subject of myths in 19th century, an ideology in 1930. Both Hitler's Germany were in fact almost 80% of the women were natural blondes, and Stalin's Russia were blondes were almost were only 8% were natural, and blondes were almost as scarce. And sexual invitation in the 1950s, with Hollywood's glorification of unintelligent blondes. Raymond Chandler points out that in Farewell, My Lovely, There are blondes and blondes, and most, and it is almost a joke word nowadays. And he wrote that in 1940. In 1960s, California set the trend of tanned blonde beauties, and the beach boards rhapsodized over the Golden Girls. We seem to be back in a never-ending realm of colors, but the message is the same. Yellow, of whatever hues, is the sun's color, evoking awe and worship. Cultural historian Hugh Ashley Wilson, writing of the shining yellow metal gold, adds a further gloss. The word gleam stems from the Indo-European root glow, glee, meaning to shine, glitter, glow, which also has its origin in the word yellow. Glow, yellow. Lovely. Just as yellow is the colour, gold is the prime metal of the sun. Prittman makes this connection. The colour gold has long been established in classical canons as beauty and power. Almost 2,000 years before Homer, in the time of Proto-Indo-Europeans, the colour was connected with the worship of the sun and fire, and the adoration of yellow dawn goddess. That's, I wish they would do that, because I've read some legends of that way. The association has endured through the centuries. Thus, James Joyce fuses solar wedge, blondness and gold into perfect tableau when Leo Bloom, suddenly bathed in the morning sunshine, reflects. Quick warm sunlight came running from Berkeley Road, swiftly in slim sandals along the brightening footpaths. She runs to meet me, a girl with golden hair on the wind. He is writing truer than he knew. Gold can indeed be found in human hair, almost the only part of the body to contain it. Oh, wow. On average, it's concentrated at the rate of 1 per 8 millionth of a gram, not enough to make a barber smile, and more adults than children, and more men than women. Well, there you go. Gold is excreted hair. There you go. The sun's association with gold is easy to understand. It's not just a matter of colour. Long before the days of alchemy, gold was regarded as the most perfect thing on earth, and thus indissolubly linked with the great star. The alchemist in Victor Hugo's The Hunchback of Notre Dame explains, gold is the sun. To make gold is to become God. The only metal that can never tarnish is gold, a suitable symbol of purity. It can be beaten into so thinly that there's hardly any solidity left, approaching the state of pure effervescence. It's often been associated not just with divinity, but because of its rarity worthy and with royalty. Every culture seems to have valued gold. In 624 BC, Pelander, tyrant of Corinth, invited the city-state's nobility to dinner and had his soldiers strip the women of their gold ornaments and gowns adorned with gold, which booty financed his rule for decades. By 760 BC, the first gold coins were minted in Lydia, which is now western Turkey. In 1284, Venice introduced the gold ducat, which became the most popular coin in the world. Columbus, sending back gold to his queen, exalted, oh, most excellent gold. Who has gold as treasure, wealth, which he gets what he wants, imposes his will on the world, and even helps souls to paradise. Well, I didn't know how Columbus actually picked up gold. I'll have to read that. Incas considered gold tears by the sun, and more coarsely its sweat, employing it only in ceremonial purposes, although Atahualpa sued for his freedom from the Spanish by having his cell, this is right, I love this one, filled with gold and had a door in the back, and they took it out higher than the man could reach. And Montezuma II sent Cortez a sun-like gold disc the size of a cartwheel. The fabled city of El Dorado was named for the king, the gilded man whom the 16th century chronicler Gonzo Finez of El Paso describes as going about continually covered with gold dust, found as fine as ground and salt. Durable, flexible, beautiful gold is also capable of myriad of uses. It resists the fiercest fire. In minute quantities, it makes windows less conductive to light. Well, that's right. And red. So nanoparticles of gold are red. The gold visors on carried in the Apollo 11 helped protect the astronauts' eyes from the intense radiation beyond the atmosphere. It has conjured cities out of the ground almost overnight, from San Francisco to Johannesburg. Above all else, it is extremely scarce. A troy ounce of the stuff today is worth more than $900. I think that's right. During mankind's time on Earth, it is only an estimated 300,000 tons has been won by the Earth, nearly all since 1848, and no more, only enough if piled up to fill the Eiffel Tower. Well, no, to fill this square underneath the Eiffel Tower. Yet it is estimated that 8 trillion tons roll undissolved in the oceans alone, or in people's hair, I believe. There's still more in the Earth's crust. As the Sun, about 6/10 billionths of its mass consists of gold, which is a huge number of tons, enough to cover Scotland half a mile deep. In an essay he wrote, so let me read that, that's, well, I think I can use this, 1.2 petatons, there you go. In an essay he wrote in 1930 on the return to the gold standard in the international markets, John Maynard Keynes considered what association with the metal evoked. In the days before the evolution of representative money, he argued, it was natural to choose a metal that was the most suitable economy for representing value. Quoting Freud, he says, there is reasons deep in our subconscious why gold should satisfy strong instincts and serve as a symbol. The magical properties which the Egyptians priestess craft accidentally imbued the yellow metal, it has never altogether lost. Now, this is interesting because Keynes had a real insight into Newton, but it was really lost. So Keynes was really into this stuff. It's really interesting reading. There's a footnote. Money has long been associated with the sun. First coined in the US government on the 6th of July, 1787, was called the Fugo, I flee, with the sun at the zenith. Over the century, Muslim sultans have held solar ceremonies in which they are weighted against the quantity of gold representing the sun, and a poor receive money accordingly. It does seem, it does duty, so to speak, for the sun on earth. The Latin word for gold, aurum, a chemical symbol, AU, is cognate with the Greek aura. It means the golden goddess of dawn. It is no surprise that the coin considered the most beautiful ever struck in the US, known as the Double Eagle, as it is twice the value of a $10 coin, known as the Eagle, contained 1 ounce of 22 carat gold. This coin, in circulation until 1933, went in response to the Depression. Roosevelt banned private ownership of gold, and revived in 2009, slightly smaller than the original, containing exactly an ounce of 24-carat gold. I don't think, I can't understand. The Liberty, striding towards the view on one side, the sun girdling the Capitol dome behind her, and on the other, an eagle in flight over a blazing sun. Flip the coin and the sun still lands heads up. Here's an asterisk to it. The tradition of stretching back 300 years dictates that British coins and later stamps show an incoming monarch's profile facing the opposite direction of her predecessors. Of the death of George V, in 1936, the appropriate mandarins were set to work. George V had faced less, so his predecessor, Edward VIII, would be looking the other way. But the new king... Oh, shit. So I've just got attacked by this insect. But the new king refused, believing that the left side showed him his better advantage. As a compromise, it was suggested that his left brain would be deployed, but photographically reversed, so the royal head would still be guessing right. Again, the new king exercised the veto. The manner in which he parted his hair on the left side was one of his better points. All this created turmoil in the royal mint and the royal post office. But one of the first issue stamps emerged with his left profile facing left. This is decreed. Unfortunately, the background prepared for the stamps had already been engraved to show the monarch looking right. And when the authorities learned Edward's wishes, they changed the direction of his gaze, but not the background. Hence, the king is shown peering into the shade rather than the sun, the opposite of an aspiring omen. After Edward's abdicated in December, Times commented, Even the strong minds can yield to its weakness. The superstitious anxiety of those who shook apprehensive head at the new stamps because the head of England, of King Edward VIII, was turned away from the light and looked forward into gloom, an apt symbol for the rain that began with everything in its favour and moved onwards to calamity. Isn't that amazing? Okay. Mirrors give back us back the sun. They're the other most potent symbols. The Egyptians invariably styled their mirrors out of a solid disc, a slightly flattened circle representing the sun as often appears on the horizon. This divine connection made the mirror a religious symbol and was used during festivals and ceremonies and even placed in tombs, often in front of the face or the breast of the corpse, to assure the presence of Ra. The Chinese hung mirrors in the temple ceiling reflecting the wisdom of heaven and drawing the sun with the fire of the sun. Other cultures link the mirrors to the sun through language. The Aztecs, for example, named their gods Tezcatlipoca, meaning smoking mirror. Japanese were unique in the provenance and ubiquities of their sun-linked mirror imagery. It's interesting, Japan. Asia means... does Asia mean? Oh, she was... where was it? I'm just really trying to get that into my head. Oh. So Asia means dawn in some sort of language. I wish I... so I have to go and see. Sanskrit, Asia means sunrise. Isn't that amazing? According to legend, when the sun goddess Amaterasu hid herself in a dark cave, a mirror hung on a tree outside. It gave her a glimpse of her own light, encouraging her to come out. Isn't that amazing? Okay. Thereafter, she ordered her grandson to Earth to create the cradle of the sun, Nippon, giving him a mirror to hand down his descendants, and sending him a whole company of mirror makers. In this myth, the mirror's identification with the reflection of the disembodied spirit of the divine light made it a terrestrial representation of the sun, and that's the most important treasure of the imperial regalia. My God. burnished gold shines back well enough, and some of the earliest Roman mirrors were linked with it. But generally, more reflective surfaces have been used, bronze, tins, mixed with mercury, and eventually silver. Isn't that amazing? Mixed mercury. By the 16th, I don't understand where that would work, mercury tin amalgam. By the 16th, it would make it very soft. By the 6th century, the main Venetian mirror makers would back a plate of glass, a thin sheet reflecting mirror, which remained the dominant method for 300 years. In modern process, backing the glass surface with the metallic silver had to wait until the 1830s when the discovery of immense deposits of silver in Australia, Central America and Europe, which drove down the value against gold by a factor of 5, and used the inventive powers of the great German chemist Schultz von Lieberg combined to make it practical. Until then, mirrors, and particularly large ones, had been extremely expensive. One reason why they cost more than a quarter of a million livres, Louis the 14th, to create the famous Hall of Mirrors. In the gallery is the glass in Versailles. The 17 windows overlooking the gardens matched by 17 vast mirrors on the wall, all crafted in Paris workshops in an attempt to outdo anything Venice could produce. It further affirmed the greatness of France and its king. When, in 1682, the hall was displayed to the royal court, its commanding success, a dazzling mass of riches and lights duplicated by 1,000 times over by just as many mirrors, creating views more brilliant than fire where 1,000 things even more sparkling came into display. There were 306 panels on all, blended together so each seemed part of a much larger sheet. The gallery, was not the only symbol of focus of the kingdom during the ancient regime, but also continued to play a role after the revolution. In 1919, the Treaty of Versailles was signed there. In her History of the Mirror, historian Sabine McCullough-Bonnet links the hall to the sun. Everything in Versailles, she writes, was spectacular magic, not the castle reflected in the water of a canal, not the symmetry of the unfolded action or the repetition of gesture in the mirror, but the first and foremost of all the rules of etiquette by which the audience of the courtiers bowed in unison. The court threw itself, thought itself a spectacle. Each person wanted to see himself be seen, to be narcissistically bedazzled, and all the glazes converged upon the eye of the Sun King, from whom all light radiated. To the Canterbury Observer, sat inside the gallery, on a bright day, it would seem that the room had been emerged into the sun, like bouncing endlessly from mirror to mirror. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll see if I can get this one out. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.